The journey to a smoke-free future can be a long and winding road, but if you're ready for a change, consider taking Zyn for a spin. Zyn nicotine pouches offer a fresh way to discover your nicotine satisfaction. Anywhere, anytime. No smoke, no spit, and no lingering odor. Get in gear with the Zyn 10 Challenge and enjoy 10 smoke-free, spit-free days for just $5.95. Order online and start your new journey today. Warning, this product contains nicotine. Nicotine is an addictive chemical.
Enjoy all your favorite sports like never before at BetMGM. Signing up and playing is so easy. Simply sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. When you register with BetMGM, you can get instant access to a variety of parlay selection features, live betting options, and the best daily promotions in the business. And with BetMGM at your fingertips, every play and every game matter more than ever. Place your moneyline, prop, and parlay bets with the king of sportsbooks today. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. That's right, up to $1,500. Again, sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 7 days. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park. That's 1-800-GAMBLER.
When you buy Kroger brand products, you feel like you're winning. That's because they offer proven quality at lower than low prices. In fact, we guarantee that you and your family will love how Kroger brand products taste, or you get your money back. So next time you're shopping for the family, look for delicious Kroger brand products, because they'll make you all feel like you're winning. Shop now, in-store, or online. Kroger, fresh for everyone.
Finding the right news podcast can feel like dating. It seems promising until you start listening.
When you hit play on Post Reports, you'll get fascinating conversations and sometimes a little fun, too. I'm Martine Powers.
And I'm Elahe Azadi. Martine and I are the hosts of Post Reports. The show comes out every weekday from The Washington Post.
You can follow and listen to Post Reports wherever you get your podcasts. It'll be a match, I promise.
The after parties at SNL, well, I've been lucky enough to go to a few.
Yeah.
And I think it was probably good that I never was a cast member on that show. I don't know that I could have done 20 of them a year.
Just the stamina wise. I mean, you definitely, like, when you start out, you want to go to as many as you can possibly can, and then you kind of grow out of them quickly. By the time I got there, I don't think Bill Hader even went to, like, the first after party. And I was like, what? You're crazy, man. This is the best job ever. We're never going to die. And then, like, halfway through season two, Bill was right.
Bill was right.
Hi, I am Taryn Killam, and I am so excited to talk to my brand new friend, Brian, all about me.
Well, hello there, everybody, and welcome back to Off the Beat. I'm your host, Brian Baumgartner. My guest today, well, you just heard, Taryn Killam, an actor who has lived many, many lives. If you consider yourself a film buff, you'll probably recognize him from 12 Years a Slave. If you were a Disney or a Nickelodeon kid, you might remember when he was still just a teenage heartthrob. You might recognize him from on stage in Hamilton as King George III. Or if you're big into comedy, you will know him for sure from his time on SNL or his new Amazon show, The NFL Pylon. What can this guy not do? Okay, he can sing, he can act, he can rap. Yes, this is true. He's rapped with many people, including both Snoop Dogg and Rob Riggle. And on top of that, he is a master impersonator, which actually helped him get one of his first big breaks. So yeah, it's safe to say, Taryn, well, he is skilled at the art of entertaining. And that's exactly what he's come here to do today. Well, that and talk about the off-the-beat moments in his life, of course. With all that said, I am very excited to bring on, well, the great and powerful Taron Killam.
Bubble and squeak, I love it. Bubble and squeak, I know. Bubble and squeak, I cook it every moment left over from the night before.
What's up, Taron?
Hey, Brian, how are you, buddy?
I'm good. How are you?
Good, good.
I am in a hotel room in Atlanta, Georgia. So not the ideal lighting situation, at least.
But. Understood. It was either going to be hotel room in Atlanta or like leftover Halloween mood lighting.
Yes. Speaking of which, I do have to comment on the art behind me.
Yes. Is it an open pomegranate that I'm looking at?
It is. Congratulations.
Yeah, I'm a bit of a pomegranate-holic.
Yeah, it seems weirdly disturbing to me, I'll be honest with you. Yes.
Yeah, it's a gruesome, the amount of magnification upon said pomegranate is too intense.
It is, I have named the piece of art Gruesome Fruit. So, there you go.
By the way, not a terrible title for a horror movie.
No, it's not.
Start writing, Brian.
Copyright me. I think that's all I have to do, right?
That's it. That's how the guilds work.
That is. How are you doing?
I'm very well, thank you. Yeah, my wife and I were actually, for the first time, you heard about the pandemic?
Yeah, I've heard about it.
So for the first time since the pandemic, my wife and I were invited to, like, you know, grown up Halloween parties without our kids.
Okay.
And we went to two over the weekend and we've aged out. We showed up. We got a drink. We like made a beeline for people we knew. We said hi and then literally did not know what to do with ourselves. We're like, I miss home.
Yeah. Now I have to ask you a question. Did you dress up?
We did. I was of like, we both kind of went classic. She was like a vampress and I was a wolf man.
All right. I mean, that's a D. Nothing on originality. Clever.
I will say my daughter's friends came over to hang like Friday night to do a little like early Halloween party. And one of her friends showed up in an FBI jacket with a warrant to search Mar-a-Lago. This is a 13-year-old child who is hipper, funnier, more clever than any costume I have ever or will ever wear.
Well, obviously we're going to talk about your career and your variety of elaborate costumes you've had
lots
over
of
the years.
Dress up. Yeah.
Lots of dress up. See, that's my thing. I don't dress up.
Yeah.
I feel like I dress up. I fulfill that itch at other times. And when it comes to Halloween, no, it's just me.
And other times you just mean like within your career, there's enough dress up that
there's enough dress up.
To, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I did put on makeup and get my hair done yesterday on Halloween and I wasn't going to go home and do it different.
Yeah.
Do you know what I'm saying?
You did do it. You did. You got your voucher.
Yeah. All right. I want to go back. You're a California boy.
Yes, sir.
This is fascinating to me. Your parents both dabbled in the entertainment industry. Your mom, singer-songwriter with the Charlie Daniels Band. Question, how many times have you heard Devil Went Down to Georgia?
I mean, even just recently, many times, because I feel like that's on a lot of Halloween playlists.
Oh, yeah.
A lot of times. She toured as a background singer for Charlie Daniels, two or three summers before I was born, something like that.
So I am from Georgia. So I feel like that song is like, I don't know. It's one of those things when you're young, you're like, they said Georgia.
Yeah. It was Charlie Daniels and like Ray Charles. Right.
That's right. That's exactly.
Yeah.
Your dad, part of a theater group, how much do you think their influence or, you know, their participation in the arts and performing that influenced you as a kid?
Massively. They were like, we attended Manhattan Beach Community Church, you know, in the first decade of my life. And they would do the sort of community church plays there. Okay. So, you know, I was in theaters, I was watching rehearsals, I was surrounded by the idea of like putting on a show before I could even kind of conceive of it or self-analyze what that meant and what that required. And then my mother took me and my two younger siblings to a commercial agent because she thought we were cute and precocious enough that maybe that would be a thing we would do well at. And of the three of us, I think I was the only one that was willing to go into a room full of strangers and be like, "Hi, I'll talk about milkshakes." So absolutely. I mean, incredibly influential and encouraging, you know, that was, it was like unconditional support before I was really even asking for it. But it wasn't until like middle school for me and like getting involved in theater drama with my peers, with my own group, where it became a sort of a self-passion where I was like, oh no, I do like this and I can excel at this too, but I also enjoy the process. And to me, I'm sure you agree, just if you enjoy doing it, the end results don't become as precious, you know?
Right. So it started out, it sounds like, as, I don't know, hobby, maybe the wrong word, but like an activity.
I think that's fair. Yeah, it was like recreational pastime. Yeah, absolutely. And just always around, like, you know, I was in productions at the church from the age of 4 or 5. Right. Because it was fun to go hang out with kids. And I think my parents, having 5 children, needed extracurriculars to find a moment to breathe. So it started that way. But in my own sort of history for myself, in my heart, in my mind, it was around 6th or 7th grade when I really started going like, oh, I love this. You know, and maybe slightly earlier, just I remember seeing Tim Burton's Batman, the first Batman.
Yes.
In like 89 and going, I love the way that movie makes me feel. That movie makes me feel like things that I only thought were pretend before could be real.
Right.
And that's, I want to do that. That sounds awesome.
Well, it sounds like right about this time, you were 12 years old. You made your first film appearance.
Yes.
Naked Gun, 33 and a third, The Final Insult. What do you remember about being cast on that? Now, was this through this commercial agent?
I think we'd moved on from the first one. And then there, like, I think it was like Cunningham was the first commercial agency I was with, and then moved to a sort of more boutique agency off Sunset called the Sanders Agency.
Okay.
And I think that's who this was through. And yeah, it was just an audition, and you know, you have to get your vouchers. You have to become Taft-Hartley before you can become SAG eligible. And Naked Gun is the thing, I think, is the job that got me Taft-Hartley, that like made me union eligible.
Okay.
And then doing a reenaction moment in an Unsolved Mysteries episode got me my card.
Okay. Wow.
Yeah. But the Naked Gun was so exciting and fun. The director of that movie directed Tommy Boy. Like his next film was Tommy Boy, which is like a cool factoid for me. Had I but known, I would have been much more of a kiss up.
One of my favorite. Just
same
straight
same
comedy
still we just
time.
Showed it to our daughters and it holds up and they were laughing throughout, you know. It's just it's timeless. It's one of the best comedies ever, I think. But it was fun to like be on set, and my role was in a parody of Jurassic Park, so like they'd kind of recreated a Jurassic Park set and that was cool. Right. And I had a stand-in who was like 12 years older than me, like a full adult man who just happened to be short enough to be my stand-in, and that was very exciting. And I was like, are we brothers now? Are we best friends? We ended up not being, unfortunately.
Okay.
He ghosted me.
I mean, it's so interesting because you started so early, started performing. Did you feel a specific affinity for comedy at this point, or was it just about performing or finding whatever job you could get, or, you know?
Yeah, I loved comedy. I always, as an audience member, always skewed towards comedies. You know, the works of Jim Carrey were incredibly influential to me and inspiring. But in terms of like what I could do, I definitely came at it, you know, in the first third of my life or career, just from trying to do as many different things as possible. You know, right. I really love musical theater. I really love drama. I love Shakespeare. I love a good mystery and thriller. And so the sort of goal or career path into comedy was not decided until I was kind of in college. That's when that took over.
Yeah. I mean, I saw some of your earlier roles, not decidedly not comedic. Judging Amy, Touched by an Angel.
Yeah.
Roswell. You start booking a number of pretty big shows at that time. Was this difficult for you to continue to go to school? Were you set schooling?
It's a good question. And there was a moment in time where, like, kind of coming out, I went to a performing arts high school here in Los Angeles. Mm-hmm. And as I was finishing school, I was auditioning a lot more and I was getting these guest roles and doing well, but then was accepted to UCLA for musical theater. And the agency I was with actually disbanded. Like, they closed shop. They just sort of shut down. And I was like, that's great. I'm just going to focus on school. I'm going to be a college student. I'm going to be here for 4 years. I'll train and then hopefully pick things back up once I graduate. But a show I'd done on Nickelodeon, The Amanda Show.
Yes.
Called back halfway through my freshman year at college. And they're like, we want to do more episodes with you, which was very flattering, very exciting. And I said, well, I don't have an agent. I've sort of stopped. I'm just kind of going to school. And the producers were like, we'll help you get all that. And they did. They're like, they got me an agent. They got me a manager, which I'd never had before.
Okay.
So that sort of like relaunched it. And then by the end of that freshman year, sort of as a fluke, I was allowed to audition for Mad TV, the sketch show that was on Fox.
Yes.
And got it. It's still funny that happened to me, because I had not taken an improv sketch stand-up class, like I had no training, but just was loud and obnoxious and a good mimic, I think,
right.
You know?
Right.
And yeah, so that is when I became like comedian Taryn Killam.
Okay, so I gotta ask you about that. So first off, isn't it crazy? My manager and I, we still have a joke about this, right? That all if you're having trouble getting a job, all you need to do is book a vacation, right?
Yes.
Like book
yes.
something
always.
That is likely non-refundable.
Yes,
or you have exactly. or you have dozens of people counting on you. You know, yeah. Plan a wedding. You're gonna get a job. So that's fascinating to me, where you consciously say, I'm going to take a little break. I'm going to go to UCLA. I'm going to train. And then everything starts hitting for you. Now I read here that first off, The Amanda Show, you almost missed your graduation.
Yeah, I did. Technically I wasn't allowed to walk.
Okay.
Because I had to miss the rehearsal. Like, I booked that job initially and it was very exciting. And the shoot dates overlapped with the graduation rehearsal. LOXA, which is the name of my high school, at that time, graduation took place at the Dorothy Chandler Pavilion, which is where the okay. Oscars used to happen before
yes.
they built the Dolby place, which is really cool, really fancy, nice honor. But the school was saying that it was the theater's policy that you had to be present for the rehearsal. And if you weren't there for the rehearsal, you were not allowed to walk on the stage. And I was like, oh, shoot. So I said to the Amanda Show, I was like, I can't do this job. I'm sorry. I'm going to miss out on my graduation. And they were so, they said, we'll do everything we can to make sure you're there for the show, to do, you know, we'll show you the dates ahead of time and if they can reschedule. And they were so accommodating. And the high school for which I was being trained to be a professional actor was not that I was like, you know what, I'm going to, they're paying me money.
Right.
So what right. happened was, true to their word, the producers shot me out early the day of my graduation, sent me in a limousine to downtown LA to the Dorothy Chandler, but then I had to sit in the audience for my high school graduation and watch all my classmates walk.
That's so stupid.
It's,
so stupid.
It all worked out.
All right. You and this guy by the name of Kenan Thompson, I hear, had the same manager. Mad TV calls for Kenan. You get pitched. You did 23 impressions during your audition. I mean, you have 23 people at this point that you can do.
Yeah, it's again the mimicry thing. Like, you know, my party trick was to have seen whatever movie was in theaters and then come back and kind of recreate it, satirize it. So at that point, like the WB network was a huge thing. So all the Dawson's Creek people, all the Buffy the Vampire Slayer people, Cruel Intentions, your Varsity Blues, like that was sort of my wheelhouse. And knowing, you know, if Mad TV was going to hire a 19-year-old kid, they'd probably want to capitalize on a that. More youth-oriented point of view. It was those, but then, you know, you'd throw in a Bono from U2 or at that point, Jimmy Fallon, like I did a Fallon for them. But yeah, for my like official audition, it's so kind of like juvenile, but charming upon reflection. But I like made cards. I did craft cards with like name titles as if, you know, there was a lower third on the screen, but I was going to be in an office. So I made 23 different cards and I wore them around my neck and I would just take one off and then do the impression and take one off and do the impression. And so like it helped it, I think, because it required me to do less work. But the best part always, like even then I was so embarrassed because the audition ends and then I got to take a solid 30 to 45 seconds to collect all these paper cards, that, like these, these 8x11 pieces of paper that have scattered all over the floor of this office at Fox Studios. But it worked. It worked. It was a very, very fortunate, lucky thing and an incredible learning experience for me.
Enjoy all your favorite sports like never before at BetMGM. Signing up and playing is so easy. Simply sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. When you register with BetMGM, you can get instant access to a variety of parlay selection features, live betting options, and the best daily promotions in the business. And with BetMGM at your fingertips, every play and every game matter more than ever. Place your moneyline, prop, and parlay bets with the king of sportsbooks today. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets. If you don't win your first bet, that's right, up to $1,500. Again, sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 7 days. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park. That's 1-800-GAMBLER.
The best conversations I have with my colleagues are the ones that happen when no one is looking, when we're not 100% sure yet what to write.
Hopefully, having conversations like this can help you figure out your own point of view. That's kind of our job as Washington Post opinions columnists. I'm Charles Lane, Deputy Opinion Editor.
And I'm Amanda Ripley, a contributing columnist. We're going to bring you into these conversations on a new podcast called Impromptu.
Follow Impromptu now, wherever you listen.
The Toolkit Podcast is where your favorite filmmakers come to talk about their craft and process.
I don't want a sloppy angle in my movie ever.
It's like being a dancer. You find the freedom in the structure.
It's where Tarantino, Gerwig, Scorsese, and Jordan Peele discuss their latest films, and showrunners take us behind the scenes of the best of TV.
Hosted by IndieWire's craft team, Toolkit is an award-winning podcast that gets at the heart of what really matters for filmmakers, like Spike Lee.
It comes back to this storytelling. What can I use in my toolbox?
There's a lot of pros to drinking Health Aid kombucha. No cons that I can think of. Pro, amazing taste. Pro, pairs well with anything. Pro, probiotic. That's a literal pro. And it's deliciously refreshing. It's the perfect pairing to your meal or great on its own, whether you're having Pink Lady Apple, Berry Lemonade, or one of the other great flavors. It's the perfect swap for soda or alcohol. Make it part of your daily routine. Look for the brown bottle with an anchor on it and try Health Aid Kombucha today.
talked to Kevin Pollak, who is actually an amazing impressionist.
Yes. I mean, his walk-in is phenomenal.
His walk-in is really good.
He said he also says like he helped Dana come up with his George Herbert Walker Bush.
Yes.
He's yeah, Kevin was at one of those Halloween parties I was at.
Okay. He talked to me about you just finding that one hook. Mm-hmm. Is that how you operate as well? Are you looking for one characteristic or speech pattern, or what are you
sometimes,
doing?
Sometimes, yeah. Sometimes a physical affectation helps it. You know what I mean? Like a mouth shape or eye squinting, you know, like it usually starts outward in for me.
For you. Okay.
Or if there is a melody to it, if there is a sound or a certain rhythm of speech, that's another way in for me. Like when I started doing Brad Pitt again, it was that thing where I'd seen the movies and then just quoting it with friends, people enjoying going like, "Oh my God, yeah, you sound like him," with no jokes at that point. But like for Brad Pitt, I really, really loved and still love Seven.
Okay.
And there's a speech he does with Morgan Freeman at the bar, and he goes, "Yeah, you know what? I don't think you're quitting because you believe that. I think you want to believe that because you're quitting. You want me to agree with you and say, yeah, it's fucked. It's all fucked up. We should all live in fucking log cabins. But I don't agree with you. I do not. Thanks for the drink." And just like the rhythm of the butter, like, and then 12 Monkeys, he's much more frenetic in that. He's much more physical. And he does always touch his face. He's always kind of licking his lips and keeping his lips moist. And there's a little like bounce, you know, a little shake to the head, a little like, I don't even have the energy to be this cool. And then in 12 Monkeys, he does a lot of that. "You get out of my chair." Yeah. There's like a lot of these like onomatopoeia sounds. So I started just buttoning like, "Hello, great to meet you. Very happy to meet you." Bah! And that's just sort of how that one in particular developed. And it just always brought me great joy because he's just undeniably the most handsome, cool, most unique performers in terms of the types of roles he chooses. But at the same time, he has a very limited vocal range. He always sounds like himself. You know what I mean? He's not like a Tom Hardy who's always going to make some big vocal swing.
Right.
Brad always sounds like Brad.
Right. See, that's genius. I love that. I also love that for you, physicality is so important for you. For me, in terms of creating a character, I always said that is equally as important, how the character moves, how they hold their body, where their holds are, lets you know so much.
Yeah. Like I find it, I don't get as self-critical when I start with the physical, right? Mm. Like bad example, someone who walks with a limp, you know what I mean? You can feel, you're feeling it. It's very real. It's very tangible. As opposed to journaling from the point of view of somebody, or, you know, all these internal exercises people do. If I start there, it feels false to me. I can get in my head. I'm like, what am I doing? Why am I writing that? What, you know, these things didn't happen. This wasn't real. I'm making this up. But if you go in physical and you start to feel that, then the thoughts behind it become a little bit more, become validated in a way to me. I just have always found that to be more helpful. Yeah.
100%. Yeah. And shoes are really important to me.
Interesting.
Because different shoes, different types of shoes ground you to the ground in a different way. And
yes,
literally creates different body postures, right?
Yeah.
Like, and this isn't a joke. I'm not even making a joke. Right now I'm wearing cowboy boots. Yeah. I appear to be a different person when I am walking down the street in these shoes as my second favorite type of shoe, a flip-flop. You know, it's the dude in the Big Lebowski versus put Jeff Bridges in boots and he immediately becomes somebody else,
True
you know?
Grit. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. So even if, you know, I try, it doesn't always happen. I'm not going to be totally high maintenance about it. But even like if I'm off camera or something and I'm trying to be there for somebody else, having the shoes, is always important for me.
Absolutely.
That puts my body in a specific position.
And the way that it affects others too. That's so, I mean, I've never thought of that, but it immediately makes sense to me, because if you enter a room in cowboy boots, people hear you coming in a different way than coming in flip-flop. Like, there's just the sound that those two different kinds of shoes make affect. Like, flip-flops is like, who's this doof, you know? And cowboy boots is like, oh, do I need to be on my guard? You know,
right?
Here comes something. Here comes the possibility of authority.
Right, and that's the great dichotomy of me. I wear both. There you go. Sometimes the same day. It's crazy.
I love that. I don't mind that one bit. Not to like dig in on feet stuff, but
yeah, okay.
I now have inflamed plantar fasciitis.
Yep.
Do we know
I've
this?
Had it.
You've had it. You know it.
Yep.
Oh boy. I shot a film in Europe this summer, came home with like a chronically sore foot. I was like, I tore something. I ripped something.
Yep.
I need surgery. I need to do it. And I go in to the podiatrist and he's like, well, no, as you get older. And I didn't hear anything he said after that.
Are you over it now?
It went away, but I've now had like two bouts of it. Like I was able to kind of curb it subsided, and then I re-aggravated it.
Yep.
And apparently it has everything to do with being an old dummy.
Yeah, kind of. But I will tell you this. I was shooting something for NFL Network, and this has been, I don't know, 6, 7, 8 years, and was there with two young NFL players at the time. And I was talking about foot things. I don't know why. It wasn't sexual, I promise. And they said, well, you get pedicures, right? I was like, no, I don't get pedicures. They're like, why not? Literally, you're walking around on those things every single day of your life. You got to take care of them.
Wow.
And I was like, you guys get pedicures? And they're like, absolutely. I'm telling you, it's totally changed my life.
Interesting.
Not joking.
May I inquire about frequency?
I mean, ideally, we're talking every month to 6 weeks.
Okay. That's very reasonable.
And I play, everybody's tuning out now, I talk about this too much, but I play a lot of golf and I like to walk and I play golf tournaments. And, you know, sometimes golf shoes are a little pointed at the end. It can cause, can cause issues. Since I started this, it is night and day for me.
Wow.
And I'm talking about playing 3, 4, 5 times, walking. I mean, you know, your feet are going to get so, you know, tired or whatever, but the pain that I had before, it doesn't exist anymore.
Phenomenal. All right.
Yep. There
That's
you go.
The gift you're giving me.
That's,
I love it.
That is the gift I am giving you today.
I'll take it.
Now back to Mad TV and the Groundlings. You start studying at the Groundlings.
Yeah, so many of the people that I really loved working with at MAD had come from there, had trained there. Michael Hitchcock in particular, Jennifer Joyce, Michael McDonald. And I'd obviously heard of the Groundlings and knew of it, and actually even had a buddy from college going through it, Mikey Day, who's now on Saturday Night Live. But because I did come in so inexperienced, but fell in love so deeply with the format of sketch and the people who I looked up to almost consistently across the board happened to be Groundling, you know, so kind of just for fun more than anything, I signed up for a class with my buddy Kyle and Nassim, who's also on SNL with me. Mm-hmm. And it was not result oriented. It was more like, let's just experience what this is like and what we can learn from it. And thank goodness, because everything that has happened since I joined up with the Groundlings Theater is because of that establishment.
Wow. You're doing a show at the Groundlings and you get an opportunity to perform for Lorne Michaels. Now, did you know he was there?
No. What happened was I was in the Sunday Company, which is sort of like the junior company.
This is prestigious, people. The Sunday Company at the Groundlings.
Yes.
This is it.
For my money, if you happen to be in Los Angeles and want to see good sketch comedy, for my money, the Sunday Company show is the one most worth seeing, because what you're doing is writing a brand new show every week. So we were doing the show Come Back at Intermission, and they written on the dry erase board, by the way, Lorne Michaels was in the audience tonight. And the dry erase board in a sketch comedy theater very frequently is used for stupid bits and not for any sincere messaging. So I kind of laughed it off. It wasn't like toward like later in the second half where people were like, no, he was, he left. He was here, but he left. And I believe he had come to see Nassim in particular because she had put she'd done a one woman show. She put together a tape. So he came and that was, yeah, that was the first chance that I had to be seen by SNL. And then they flew four of us, Nassim, myself, Jillian Bell, and Greg Roman out to audition like less than a month later.
Was this another opportunity, another job for you, or did this hold a special significance for you at that time?
I mean, my process with SNL was I had to audition twice that year, didn't get it, audition a third time a year later, and that's when I got the job. By the time I was working my way up in the Groundlings in the writing lab and advanced class, SNL had become like the dream goal, right? Like that. Okay. And I had confidence that if I ever had the opportunity to be seen, because there's a little bit of circumstance, right? It's like some of the most talented, funniest sketch performers in the world just didn't fall in a window where SNL needed people or needed that type or happened to be looking, whatever. There's so much luck and circumstance in this industry, but I did know if I got seen and if I was able to audition, I would have a good shot. I just felt confident about that. And so the first audition was like validation of that. Like it was kind of a party. It was like me and three of my favorite people to perform with flying to New York, which was so exciting. Like I even paid for a limousine to like pick us up from the airport and drive us into Manhattan, and I made a mix CD of all New York themed songs. It was a party. It was just like, I've been invited there to perform, you know, inside this hallowed ground to me, this institution, this temple of comedy, if you will. So the first time was just fun and just about soak it all in. And no matter what, they saw you and they said that, yes, you're good enough to be considered, you know, and that was enough. And I truly had already made peace with that before I even auditioned. You know what I mean? It's just like, great. That's a thumbs up from a show that truly has shaped my sensibilities. They're going like, yeah, we like what you do. Good enough. Then I find out a couple weeks after my audition, they like you and they want to bring you back. And for whatever reason, that like just changed the molecular structure of it for me. Cause then it became like, oh, now it's mine to lose. Now they said yes, but now they're like on a razor's edge of whether or not to do it. So if I give everything I can, then it's within my grasp. But also I've got to give them 5 new minutes of material. And so it's all going to be the stuff I cut out of the first audition.
Right.
And the second one went fine-ish. And they even said after it, like, it's not now, but it's not never. And he's on our radar. And I took that with a grain of salt. And then true to their word, a year later, they called out of the blue, really. They hadn't even seen me perform again. They just kind of called me up. And third time was a charm.
What was your favorite character you created on SNL?
Ooh. I really loved the French dance sketches we would do, which was like a really weird, warped, like, what is the CW for France? Based off, if you had to design what a teen show is in France, based off of American stereotypes.
Right.
Those are like putting on a show. They were like a little different because they weren't like written joke sketches. They were performative physical pieces. So they're always so joyful to perform. A character that I'd done at Groundlings, like, was this character Eddie, who we did it with Justin Bieber, and like he's this insecure older brother who's trying to intimidate his younger sister's boyfriend, who's nothing but impressive, and the only thing he can hold on to is that the guy says, "It's glad to meet you." Sorry, glad to meet you. Nice to meet you, and he won't let up about that. just the pettiness of that. And then I loved the Maryville brothers that we did, which was kind of like based off of a physical thing I'd done at Groundlings, but we kind of created its own structure. Rob Klein and Kent Sublett and I did like these possessed animatronic creatures that, like, if you go to, like, you know, a state fair carnival, the poor manufacturing is horrifying in itself. It's like, even if it's the sweetest little, like, you know, like, hey, come to Lollipop Land. It's somehow more terrifying than if it was like a killer clown.
Your favorite impression or person you impersonated?
Coming onto the show, I was always proud of my Brad Pitt, but like you put something on a national stage and it's a very good indicator of how subjective something is. like I love it and there are groups of people who love it, but it was not like widely received. But one that I kind of like developed on the show was Christoph Waltz was always really, really fun to do. Just such a great character in him, in and of himself. And he hosted while I was there. And then I got to do him for Celebrity Jeopardy at the 40th anniversary. And that was really cool.
That was genius.
Thanks, dude.
You got to meet so many incredible people who hosted. Who surprised you the most with how funny they were?
It was always the like former kid performers, like anybody who came from like multicam Disney show or Nickelodeon show, who then most likely transitioned into music. So I'm thinking like Timberlake or Miley Cyrus or Drake even. Drake had done Degrassi Junior High before becoming Drake as we know him now. But they just have it built into their DNA. Like how to perform for a crowd, how to cheat out, how to play to the fourth wall, how to do, you know, the timing of a joke. So they were always the most fun just because you could tell that they got it, you know, right away. And they made things better. You didn't have to write around them. You could write something for you to do together and know together. That they would pull it off or make it even better.
I also hear Drake hosted a big after party.
Yeah, because he's hosted a few times. I think he even hosted once after I was on the show, maybe, but the one I think you're talking about is he rented out the Dave and Buster's in Times Square.
Okay.
And free drinks, and everybody got like a cup full of tokens to play games. But he also flew in, I guess, a bunch of dancers from a strip club that he's like a co-owner of in Toronto. So there was a very strong divide of attendees at that after. This isn't the after party. This is the after. So this is getting going at like 3 a.m.
Yes.
And it's like half of the Dave and Buster's is filled with like comedy performer writers who are actually playing the games. And half are just like very attractive stripper girls who are just doing everything they can to position themselves close to Drake, who's standing with his buddy at the DJ booth. So it's just like, it was just really great kind of like dichotomy of people with different goals.
Yeah. The after parties at SNL. Well, I've been lucky enough to go to a few.
Yeah.
I think it was probably good that I never was a cast member on that show. I don't know that I could have done 20 of them.
Just the stamina wise. I mean, you definitely like when you start out, you want to go to as many as you can possibly can. And then you kind of grow out of them quickly. By the time I got there, I don't think Bill Hader even went to like the first after party. And I was like, what? You're crazy, man. This is the best job ever. We're never going to die. And then like halfway through season two, Bill was right.
Bill was right.
So did you you've done like afters? Like you've done the whole shebang?
Oh, no, I've done it. Yeah,
it. Do you remember what locations they were? Because it changes. The after especially.
Well, the after, yeah, I will never be able and probably shouldn't pull the name of that. But very dark bar. Very dark. And I'm sure that's all intentional. One of them was, it was a season finale. So I think it was like there in Rockefeller Center was the after. And then there was somewhere else. And here's the thing you have to understand. You don't leave the show until after midnight.
Correct.
And so you're like having dinner at 1:30 in the morning and suddenly things get later. But it weirdly doesn't feel that way because it's the whole energy of it. And it's like this dark, dark bar. And suddenly you're like, okay, it's time to go. And you open that door and it is bright. It is bright.
Yeah.
Bright on the streets of New York and everyone is moving fast. It's it's a thing.
Like what other job ever is it like that? And that's a weekly occurrence too.
I know. Yeah, I know. I know. It's insane.
Enjoy all your favorite sports like never before at BetMGM. Signing up and playing is so easy. Simply sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. When you register with BetMGM, you can get instant access to a variety of parlay selection features, live betting options, and the best daily promotions in the business. And with BetMGM at your fingertips, every play and every game matter more than ever. Place your moneyline, prop, and parlay bets with the king of sportsbooks today. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets. If you don't win your first bet, that's right, up to $1,500. Again, sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 7 days. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park. That's 1-800-GAMBLER.
Finding the right news podcast can feel like dating. It seems promising until you start listening.
When you hit play on Post Reports, you'll get fascinating conversations and sometimes a little fun, too. I'm Martine Powers.
And I'm Elahe Azadi. Martine and I are the hosts of Post Reports. The show comes out every weekday from The Washington Post.
You can follow and listen to Post Reports wherever you get your podcasts. It'll be a match, I promise.
The Toolkit Podcast is where your favorite filmmakers come to talk about their craft and process.
I don't want a sloppy angle in my movie ever.
It's like being a dancer. You find the freedom in the structure.
It's where Tarantino, Gerwig, Scorsese, and Jordan Peele discuss their latest films, and showrunners take us behind the scenes of the best of TV.
Hosted by IndieWire's craft team, Toolkit is an award-winning podcast that gets at the heart of what really matters for filmmakers, like Spike Lee.
It comes back to this storytelling. What can I use in my toolbox?
There's two kinds of people in the world, people who love Health Aid kombucha and people who have never tried it. The bubbly mix of probiotic tea and refreshing juice is delicious and good for your gut health, with great flavors to choose from that you can't help but love. If you've never tried it before, maybe try a bottle or can of passion fruit tangerine or ginger lemon. Your taste buds and your gut will thank you. Look for the brown bottle with an anchor on it and try Health Aid kombucha today.
Health Aid kombucha.
Around the time you were leaving SNL, you took on another such an exciting project: writer, director, star, Killing Gunther with Arnold Schwarzenegger. How did Arnold become part of this project?
Again, just sort of random circumstance. We just overshot the mark. Like, that film was conceived and always intended to be like a scrappy production.
Let's put on a show.
You'll put on a show. And the benefit of SNL is that it's such a respected place. People will listen to you. And I was not used to that in any of my previous jobs. So in the script, in its original form, there was always going to be this cameo at the end of the movie. And I was like, oh, who would be fun to like casually get a name? Like, could you imagine if we got Jeff Goldblum? Like, how cool would that be? Right. And we sort of went down the list, and Bruce Willis had hosted, and I'd had a really good week, a good experience with him. So we reached out. He took a while to consider it and then ultimately passed. But his reps were also Arnold's reps. And they're like, you know, Arnold hasn't been doing a ton of acting, and he says he's ready to kind of get back into it, and he loves doing comedy, and he thinks that this plays to his strength. I mean, like, they're selling me on Arnold Schwarzenegger. Let me think about it. So he read it and said yes. And him coming on board was like the biggest, most exciting thing ever. But I know in hindsight now, like, was not prepared enough to pivot the project when you have the world's biggest action star agreeing to do your silly little scrappy hitman comedy. If I knew then what I know now, I definitely would have like used as him as in a much larger capacity, you know, not necessarily right with more shooting days or whatever, but you want to build it around him. Cause I think what I hear from the biggest criticism of it is like, we love Arnold, but we do have to wait an hour and 15 minutes before we see him. And I'm like, yep, that's fair. That's fair. Yeah.
Right.
But he was the best. He was a pro, man. He was like the pro of all pros. And I don't just mean prepared, which he was. Such a pleasure to work with. The graciousness with every person he crossed paths with on the street, in our, from our crew, from our cast. He is a movie star, capital M, capital S. And it was so, so fun to work with him.
How great is that to hear? I love to hear that.
Yeah. You see it. You see the extra gear. Like, that's what it was for me, is that it was a masterclass in like complete authenticity. That was the other thing. Like, it never felt contrived. It never felt forced. And he was very good at also setting boundaries and limits and like, okay, yeah. All right, good to see you. Goodbye. Like, he just clearly had been in 1,000 bajillion interactions and had really honed how to be a man of the people, you know, obviously also through his political career.
Right.
But yeah, but just a pro and just loving the process again. Like, if you just love the process of hanging out with a group and collaborating and being artistic, all the money for status, fame stuff ultimately becomes less important because you're already so fulfilled in just the craft of creating. And he had that. He was awesome.
Well, you have this experience, you direct Killing Gunther, you then, now I'm really going to fanboy here for a second. And also, I think that one of the greatest comedic, powerful characters on the stage over the last 25 years is King George III in Hamilton, which you have the opportunity to go and play on Broadway. I cannot tell you how much I love that role. I love it so much. Talk to me about that. Like, what was it like for you after all of this time on SNL to kind of go back to those theater roots and play a part that, quite frankly, has a really low lift job night to night, yet consistently steals the show?
Yeah. I mean, there certainly was symmetry to it of like, I achieved this dream goal, you know, I can't believe how fortunate I am, and then found my way back to musical theater, and not just any musical theater, but the most popular, beloved musical theater production, certainly of the last 20 years, but arguably in history. Like, that
longer
show
is
just a masterpiece, in my humble opinion. It was certainly surreal. I suddenly, I hadn't felt that level of nervousness because it was such a beloved piece, because the reputation of this show was bigger than any part in it, any person. Like, you know, my daughter's at school and there's 6 and 7 year old kids with like A. Dot Ham hats and A. Dot Burr. Right. It just penetrated culture in a way that few things have on that level. And you were constantly surrounded by reminders of that. So jumping in to this well-oiled machine, I put a lot of pressure on myself to kind of, you know, step up and match the caliber of quality that Hamilton deserves, and worked really hard at that, and eventually was able to settle into the joy of doing 8 shows a week, and that you go, okay, and you get more confident and you can try new things and you discover new moments that, oh, that's good. And that always gets a laugh. And you discover a thing where you go like, nah, that's off game. We tried that once and we'll never go back to it. yeah. I loved it. I loved it. And, you know, I did the show for 3 months, which was like a really healthy, very short period of time comparatively, because sort of like the minimum run anyone does in a Broadway show is about 6 months. So, but it was just rewarding on a daily basis to work with such a talented group of people in such new ways. You know what I mean? These incredible dancers, these incredible musicians, the designers, the directors, everybody. And then to create an experience 8 times a week for 1,300 people each show never lost it was always emotional, quite honestly. Like, you'd finish the show and you'd feel emotional. It never felt like a grind, or it never felt not special. Each performance, there was always something happening either in the audience or on stage with the cast that just made it so special. And that will forever be like, what's your favorite job you've ever had? It's hard not to think of that one first.
You know, I don't know Lin-Manuel Miranda, and I certainly don't mean any disrespect about this. This may be the craziest theory in the history of anything. Here's my theory. Okay, when I was a kid, Dorothy in The Wizard of Oz, the Scarecrow, the Tin Man, these were all, I had zero interest in these characters. I had zero interest. And by the way, they maintain most of the screen time of The Wizard of Oz. Spoiler alert for those of you who haven't seen The Wizard of Oz.
Brian, no!
The Wicked Witch, to me, is the greatest role. But more than that, I want to talk Disney. These early Disney movies, The Little Mermaid, Ursula, the Sea Witch, to me, is hilarious. And these were always the parts that were fascinating to me, like the evil villain roles, because, you know, to me, comedy always brings a complexity. That's my problem with so much like straight drama, if you will, is just like, wait a second. Like, people do make jokes occasionally, or like use sarcasm or whatever. I love that. And I see that role in that history. There's no question here. By the way, I'm just telling you, this is a theory that I have.
No, I think you're right on the money. There's an archetype there. And, you know, Pontius Pilate from Jesus Christ Superstar was always something that I referenced. But Little Mermaid and Beauty and the Beast and Aladdin, this is Howard Ashman and Alan Menken, that seem to really understand the necessity of exactly what you're saying, of brevity within darkness, right? Of humor within the shadow that exists in all of us. And Little Shop of Horrors has that in The Dentist.
The Dentist, yes.
Totally. Yeah. So yeah, no, I think you're absolutely right. I mean, yeah, that Ursula song is so phenomenal because it's really your first intro to her, to that character. This is not a character, as you pointed out with the Wicked Witch of the West, you don't spend as much time with that character, but by the end of Poor Unfortunate Souls, you know everything and want more from this character, from her, you know?
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, anyway, I love that you said that will always be the favorite role you ever played. But out of that, your first time headlining a sitcom, Single Parents, Leighton Meester, Brad Garrett. What was it like for you after spending so much time creating new shows and new characters week after week, Mad TV, SNL specifically? Was there a difference for you in terms of exploring that singular character week after week?
Absolutely. Yeah. The consistency of it. And as opposed to starting from scratch every week, you kind of got to create a collage, you know, and you kept adding pieces, you kept discovering new things about this character from the performance standpoint. I mean, I loved that job so much because we all just really liked each other off camera too, which is
important.
Hopefully you've been. Yeah. It's a shame that it needs to be said that that's special, but it is, you know. It was really a great group. And I just love the premise. When Liz Merriweather pitched me the idea originally, she's like, a group of single parents figure. I'm like, I can't believe that hasn't been a world explored in a show yet. Cause I think that there's no more admirable plight than a single parent, you know, trying to work and trying to raise, and all the balance of that it's hard enough with two parents, you know? And yeah, and just really, really enjoyed it. Your question kind of hit the nail on the head. It was definitely a different sensation to like, oh, I'm playing this guy all the time. I found it very comfortable. I found like I really enjoyed it. And I found there's such an endearingness to a network sitcom where you know what they're trying to appeal to, sort of the broadest audience possible. But I loved it. And it was also like, moving back to Los Angeles, new city, trying to get settled, that job really held me. It's like the consistency of it and the stability of it was such a beautiful gift for me and for my family. And I would have done it if they'd let us do more of it. I would have done it for forever.
Yeah. You a sports fan?
I'm a very big football fan.
Okay.
That's my new job. Is no,
I know. You let me transition.
All right. Okay. You opened it up as an open ended question.
This is not Jay Leno. This is me. this is me. So Los Angeles.
I grew up playing sports. Los Angeles. What's the deal with? I hear you've been in Los Angeles.
So Los Angeles, like? But primarily football. That's your
Grew up playing baseball and soccer mostly, like for a solid decade. Always really enjoyed the culture surrounding football, the gathering on Sundays, the Super Bowl parties, the rooting for your team. I just was always drawn to that and surrounded by that. But being from LA, did not have a team of my own to identify with for most of my life. So
yes.
Always promised that when we got a team back, which I was confident we would, that I was going all in from the new ground floor. The St. Louis Rams were, obviously a huge part of the franchise history, and then Los Angeles before that. But I've been all in since they returned in 2015, 2016.
You can't watch football now without seeing this guy talking about his new show, the NFL Pylon. It's a brilliant idea. I have worked in the world of sports as well. And here's the thing that I find so amazing is how engaging, fun, personable, funny, talented so many of the players are. Have you had any opportunities to meet players that have surprised you thus far, or have been some of your favorites that maybe you didn't know before from working on the
100%.
Show? 100%.
We've had some people, initially we had like more casual players turned commentators, Rich Orenberger, Jared Quick Campbell, Calais's younger brother, who did actually, he played on a practice team professionally. But then we got DeMarcus Ware, which was fantastic and intimidating. And what's this going to be? And he set the precedent of, as you said in your setup, like there's so much charisma and there's so many other facets to these professional athletes who you think they're driven. You think they're jocks and singular focus and win. But I think more often than not, they need to have a flip side to that, right? Like they, because they're so driven in their athletic career, they want to laugh and make fun of themselves and of football more than anybody. And DeMarcus was phenomenal. And he did DeMarcus's Remarcuses was the segment we wrote for him. And he was just a huge Anglophile and very excited that he loves England first and foremost and football second. And it was really funny. And then we had Ricky Williams come on and he killed it. He was amazing. And then we've had Richard Sherman's done stuff for us. Andrew Whitworth. We had Jimmy Johnson, so we have found in our very new 8 episodes of this NFL produced comedy show that particularly athletes and coaches are very excited to participate in something ridiculous because everything else is so laser focused and buttoned up. So it's cool to be that outlet for them.
It's genius too, because look, the NFL, if they're not taking over the world, they're taking over live television for sure. And, nobody watches anything, sports included, like they watch the NFL. And so, I've been saying forever, giving alternative programming that's fun, that focuses still on the key storylines and people of the NFL, that people eat it up. I'm so happy for your success on that.
Thanks, dude.
Really, really fun. And just keep killing it. Keep entertaining football fans. But here's the thing. You don't even have to be a football fan to enjoy you and that.
Yeah, I mean, that's the weird juxtaposition of my interests, right? I'm a legitimate football fan. That's why Prime reached out to me, just because if you happen to follow me on social media, it's pretty much the most dominant topic in my Instagram feed is my passion for the Rams. So they knew that there was a legitimacy to my interest and my love and knowledge of football. But listen, spoiler alert, exclusive, We're opening up with a Sweeney Todd bit this week. So I guarantee you there's no other football focused show on television or in the streaming universe that is mixing Sondheim with the NFL.
Yes, that is amazing. Taryn, thank you so much for taking the time and coming to talk to us. Your career is fascinating. You are hilarious. I hate you for playing that role. There's so much here, but I will continue to enjoy you and watch both the NFL and you.
Thank you,
on
buddy.
The NFL pylon.
Thank you so much. The enjoyment is mutual, and I so appreciate you having me and making this time.
Awesome. Thanks, Taryn.
Thanks, Brian. Take care.
Taryn, thank you so much for stopping by. Awesome to get to know you just a little bit better. And I cannot wait until December 19th when the Packers beat the Rams again. Listeners, I hope you enjoyed today's episode. And if you're wondering where I'll be next Tuesday, the answer is, well, here, of course. And who will be joining me? Well, let's just say they're a master of all things mathematical and savage. I'll see you then. Off the Beat is hosted and executive produced by me, Brian Baumgartner, alongside our executive producer, Ling Lee. Our senior producer is Diego Tapia. Our producers are Liz Hayes, Hannah Harris, and Emily Carr. Our talent producer is Ryan Papa Zachary, and our intern is Sammy Katz. Our theme song, Bubble and Squeak, performed by the one and only Creed Bratton.
The journey to a smoke-free future can be a long and winding road, but if you're ready for a change, consider taking Zyn for a spin. Zyn nicotine pouches offer a fresh way to discover your nicotine satisfaction. Anywhere, anytime. No smoke, no spit, and no lingering odor. Get in gear with the Zyn 10 Challenge and enjoy 10 smoke-free, spit-free days for just $5.95. Order online and start your new journey today. Warning, this product contains nicotine. Nicotine is an addictive chemical.
Hello there. I'm Ann Thompson, editor-at-large for IndieWire.
And I'm IndieWire's deputy film editor, Ryan Latanzio.
And we're the co-hosts of IndieWire's weekly Screen Talk podcast.
Join us each week for an in-depth discussion of the latest in film and TV industry news, with special guests along the way, including filmmakers and executives.
Hear from us every Friday morning on iHeart platforms or wherever you get your podcasts, as IndieWire shares what we've learned from the movie week that was.
There's a lot of pros to drinking Health Aid kombucha. No cons that I can think of. Pro, amazing taste. Pro, pairs well with anything. Pro, probiotic. That's a literal pro. And it's deliciously refreshing. It's the perfect pairing to your meal or great on its own, whether you're having Pink Lady Apple, Berry Lemonade, or one of the other great flavors. It's the perfect swap for soda or alcohol. Make it part of your daily routine. Look for the brown bottle with an anchor on it and try Health Aid Kombucha today.
You don't have to hop a plane to see the world. This month's Free This Week picks on Xfinity brings you around the globe. Experience life at a European resort in the hit comedic drama Seaside Hotel from Walter Presents. Watch romance blossom abroad in a Scottish love scheme from Hallmark Movies Channel. Celebrate Earth Month with planet-saving docuseries like Eco Eye with Duncan Stewart on Magellan TV. And be transported to your happy place with iHeartRadio's Feeling Good playlist. Just say Free This Week into your Xfinity voice remote.